Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alexander Motl, who's a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter. He previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University and is a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empires, and theory. He's the author of a number of books, including Dilemmas of Independence, Ukraine After Totalitarianism, and The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Developments of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919 to 1929. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Motl.
Thanks for having me.
And it's pretty shocking for the new leader of Ukraine, not that he doesn't have his hands full now with a Russian military occupation of Crimea and a threatened occupation of the eastern part of Ukraine, but he's just discovered that the treasury is bare and that they have $37 billion in loans have disappeared from Ukraine's treasury, and that up to $70 billion has been sent out of the country during Yanukovych's presidency. So obviously, on top of the military challenges, he's got economic challenges. But let's start with the military challenges. What's your understanding where we stand now with a call for mobilizing the Ukrainian military?
Well, the military, as you say, has been mobilized. They've also started calling in adult males to sign up. There seems to be an adequate response to that. There have been all sorts of statements by leading intellectuals, ordinary people, and others, both Russian speakers and Ukrainian speakers, that they will pick up arms and fight for the country. One of the most poignant ones was a statement by Ukraine's first president, Leonid Kravchuk, who said that even though he's 80 years old, he'll pick up a gun and fight. So there has been this mobilization, and it's very, you know, that's obviously of some importance. One hopes that it never comes to the point of needing to be used, that is to say, the army. But it's certainly a statement on the part of the government that they will at least try to retain their integrity and sovereignty. I think in some ways more important as a signal to Putin vis-a-vis his potential intentions in other parts of Ukraine and especially in the east are three things. One is just today, Ukraine's richest man, the oligarch Renat Akhmetov, who happens to be based in Donetsk, which is also, and he was also Yanukovych's primary financial supporter, issued a statement in support of Ukraine's integrity and sovereignty and peace and all those sorts of things. He also called upon Russian businessmen to try to act in some kind of peaceful manner. That is very important because that makes him the fifth such oligarch, four of whom are Russian speakers, and not even ethnic Ukrainians necessarily, who've come out in support of Ukrainian integrity in the last few days. And inasmuch as money does decide many things, not just in Ukraine, this is significant. The other significant development is that in two of the key oblasts, the provinces in eastern Ukraine, Dnipropetrovsk and Donetsk, two of the key oligarchs from that region, Mr. Taruta in Donetsk and Mr. Kolomoisky in Dnipropetrovsk, have agreed to be governors. That, I think, again, is a very significant step and should be stabilizing in as much as they've got the financial clout and now they'll presumably have some political clout. And last but not least, today, there have been mass demonstrations in a whole series of East Ukrainian cities, even in some of the least likely places like Odessa, Mykolaiv, and others, where anywhere from 5 to 10 to 15,000 people have been demonstrating against war, against Putin's intervention, and in support of sovereignty and integrity. All of these, I think, are potentially stabilizing factors, and they should certainly serve as signals to Vladimir Putin that he may have to think not just twice, but perhaps even three or four times before he embarks on another adventure in eastern Ukraine.
But it seems as though Putin, almost what's happened in the build-up to this crisis is in Russia, in terms of the way the media in Russia has been used to whip up this war fever. It's almost like a psyop, what Putin has done. And I thought, you know, last week that this was heading this way, because I didn't see how Putin could walk back from calling all these people in Kiev terrorists, etc., and fascists.
Right.
And it's true that, you know, that they are unelected. You have had a revolution there. And it would seem to me that this is a critical time for the people in Kiev to reach out and reassure the Russian-speaking people in the east. And I'm not sure that they've done that. In fact, there have been talk about Ukrainian being the official language and this kind of stuff. So how much of hotheads in Kiev stirring up or giving Putin the kind of excuses, not that he really needs them, but the ones that he's using,
right?
You know?
Well, the only step that they've taken, which was considered to be controversial, this was done about a week ago, is the parliament rescinded a law passed by the Yanukovych regime about 2 years ago. It was called the Law on Minority Languages and Regional Languages. And at the time that the law was passed, it was roundly criticized by virtually the entire Ukrainian intelligentsia, intellectuals, artists, and so on, as being discriminatory, but against Ukrainian. And that was ultimately its intent. I mean, it partly gave certain advantages to Russian. I don't think anybody would have objected to that. But it actually demoted the status of Ukrainian within the country. So they dismissed the law, they rescinded the law, and there was, of course, concern in the East. As soon as that happened, however, this is the important thing, a number of actions followed. First of all, the day after, 2 days after, roughly, a group of intellectuals in Lviv, the western Ukrainian city, stated that for an entire day they would only speak Russian in solidarity with their brethren in the East. That was then picked up by intellectuals in Odessa, Luhansk, and Donetsk, who said that in turn they would only speak Ukrainian for that day. Well, that didn't seem to assuage the tempers of the hotheads in the Eastern Oblast. And in response to that, 3 days ago, roughly, 3 days, I believe, the acting president said he vetoed that particular rescindment of that particular bill. So now part of the Yatsenyuk government's task is to write a new law on languages, which would presumably assuage both East, West, Ukrainian speakers as well as Russian speakers. In addition to that, the acting president issued a statement yesterday that he intends to expand the rights of the provinces and regions, and that's one of the main demands made by the Easterners. My sense personally is that if this were simply a question of Kiev versus the eastern or southern, or for that matter, western provinces, then it's pretty much the kind of tussle that you encounter in most complex, multicultural, multinational states. And there's usually a formula that you can work out. There's usually a deal that you can work out. You give them a little bit of this or a little bit of that. You restructure certain rules, more autonomy, less, you know, more money, more autonomy, more rights, more language, more culture, something along those lines. The problem for Ukraine is that regardless of what people in Kiev do, whether they're hotheads or not, Putin and his media have their own particular agenda. And they impose their own particular views on whatever happens to be taking place. They propagate that in the media. They find supporters of those views in Ukraine's eastern oblasts, and the result is, well, what we have. So in a way, ultimately, it really all depends on Putin. If he wants a peaceful resolution, I think it's there. It's easy to come up with something like that. If he doesn't want a peaceful resolution, I'm not exactly sure that there's anything Kiev can do to satisfy him. Well, short of, I guess, you know, just giving up the ghost and surrendering.
Right, total capitulation.
Right.
Again, I'm speaking with Alexander Model, who's a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter. He previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University and is a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empires, and theory, and is the author of Dilemmas of Independence, Ukraine After Totalitarianism, and The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Development of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919 to 1929. So, obviously, Putin's basic point of having to protect Russian-speaking and ethnic Russians in Crimea and in the east of, because he did basically use the word Ukraine. He didn't specifically say he was just going to protect people in Crimea, but in Ukraine in general. So he has pretty much it's an open book on what he might do next. But
I think you're absolutely right. That's the dangerous part. I mean, the takeover of Crimea is worrisome. It's dangerous. It's essentially an act of imperialism. But for better or for worse, it's localized. It's focused on the Crimea. The problem is that yesterday he made an appeal to the Council of the Federation of the State Council of Russia, in which he requested that they give him the right to defend Russian citizens and co-brethren, that's the terminology, quote, on the territory of Ukraine, and then, quote, until conditions in the country normalize. Now, territory of Ukraine means anywhere, as you just said. And until conditions in the country normalize means that Putin decides when conditions in the country normalize, which means, in other words, anywhere and for an indefinite period of time.
Well, it also means that he could make this argument that we need to reconstitute the Soviet Union, because if he is free to act to protect Russian minorities, even though they're not necessarily being harassed or repressed in any way. That would, he can move into Estonia under that excuse, Latvia, all over the place. There's Russian minorities. So that's the part of it that I find extraordinary. But again, you know, this is somebody whose political modus operandi is to essentially stir up Russian nationalism and appeal to sometimes to the darkest side. This is probably very popular in Russia.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, there is this perception on the part of many Russians that the Russians in places like Estonia, Latvia, Belarus, Ukraine, Kazakhstan are experiencing enormous oppression and things like that. And, of course, by and large, that's just not the case. I mean, if they're living in countries with poor economies like Ukraine, then they're likely to be as bad off as anybody else. But there's nothing specifically Russian about the poverty that they might have to endure. Alternatively, if they're living in countries like Estonia and Latvia, then, of course, they're very well off because they've got access to the European Union and all the goodies that that brings. None of that seems to matter to policymakers in Moscow, like Putin, or for that matter, his colleagues in the State Duma, where they have these, frankly, you know, perverted notions of what's actually going on to their brethren, as they call them, in these particular regions. You know, at the risk of being very provocative, but I do think one of the parallels that one has to keep in mind is the similarity between Putin and his rise to power and his appeals to nationalism and these kinds of minority issues in neighboring states, and those exercised by a certain German 70, 80 years ago. We find there are very striking and, of course, very worrisome parallels. I mean, looking for Sudetenlands where, you know, Russians are presumably being oppressed.
Well, certainly that is a similar MO to Hitler's, the idea that you have to rescue your brethren, and that's just a convenient excuse for a territorial grab. But what's your sense then? We started out talking about the economic challenges that Yatsenyuk, the new president, has. That's pretty bad in itself, right? $70 billion has been has gone out of the country during Yanukovych's right. presidency. So the treasury's bare. You've got the Russians essentially taken over Crimea, now threatening over to take over the East. What could be? I mean, there's not much that the U.S. or Europe can do. Is it possible? And if I called you next week, that you would your former country would be a third of, or two thirds of what it used to be, or even half, about a half, right?
Well, my sense is that. Well, let me answer 2 points. I mean, one regarding the state of the economy. Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a mess. It's a catastrophe, and it's likely to remain a mess, if not a catastrophe, for a certain period of time. On the other hand, I do suspect that the West, especially now in light of the incursion in Crimea, will be rather more inclined to be supportive of Ukraine economically and financially. It's no longer just a question of propping up a potentially democratic or a genuinely democratic government. Now it's a question of actually stopping an aggression. So that will work to Ukraine's benefit. By the same token, as you know, Liechtenstein, Switzerland, and Austria just declared last week that they would be freezing the accounts of something like 18 or 20 top Ukrainian officials from the Yanukovych government. So there's at least the potential for some kind of restitution of the money that they stole. And then last but not least, what works in at least to some degree to the benefit of the Yatsenyuk government, if and when this crisis calms down, is the fact that there has been this significant rallying around the flag, both by Ukrainian speakers and by Russian speakers. I'd alluded to that before. And I think that that will make it significantly easier for him to introduce the kinds of radical, painful measures that are unavoidable. I mean, people will appreciate that something has to be done or else. As to your other question, well, will Ukraine be at what it is at present? Obviously, it all depends on, you know, again, as I don't want to weasel out of it, but clearly it depends much on what Putin will or will not do. My sense is that the furthest he'll go in terms of further annexations is perhaps something like Luhansk, which has a large Russian population, which has always been very pro-Soviet, pro-Russian. That might be relatively easy to pull off. Although there, too, according to a public opinion survey that was just published today, only 32% of the total population supports annexation to Russia, which of course means that 68% are opposed to it. Nevertheless, that might be doable. My guess is that places like Kharkiv, Donetsk, Zaporozhye are no longer, will not be as easy to swallow as Crimea was. And remember, Crimea already had a large contingent of Russian forces. You could invade simply by telling them to leave their barracks. The eastern oblasts are a little more complicated. One actually has to cross an international border or alternatively drop in parachutes. There is very likely to be resistance by at least some elements of the army, at least some elements of the internal forces, at least some elements of the population. So it wouldn't be a cakewalk. Putin would have to be very, very foolhardy at this point in time to undertake that kind of step. That said, let me temper what I've just said by underlying that a week ago, I would have said, and I did say, that Putin would have had to be very foolhardy to attack Crimea. And he did. So, in a sense, all bets are off, because it's not clear that he's motivated by any kind of strategic geopolitical calculus of costs and benefits, but instead seems primarily to be motivated by his own need for legitimacy, his own need for chest beating and for demonstrating to the street in Russia that he's still a strong man. And if that's the case, if he's this kind of irrational individual then we just don't know.
Well, Alexander Myrdal, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Alexander Myrdal. He's a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter. He previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University and is a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empires, and theory, and is the author of a number of books, including Dilemmas of Independence, Ukraine After Totalitarianism, and The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Development of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919 to 1929. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.